Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the East-West Psychology Podcast, the forum for the exploration of psyche and spirit. Join our hosts, Jonathan Kay and Stefan Julich, and their guests as they delve into the intersection of psychology, philosophy, world wisdom traditions, the arts, and more.
In this episode, we meet longtime East-West Psychology faculty member, Kimmy Johnson, who describes her transformative journey starting as a student of consciousness studies and traditional knowledge at CIIS to becoming an elder in the East-West Psychology community, teaching ancestral consciousness and healing, dreams as indigenous knowledge, and shamanic and earth-based traditions. Kimmy shares pedagogical approaches and offers insights into how ancestral remembrance and traditional knowledges can help us examine what has been absorbed from our life experiences, our families, and our culture, and offer earth-based and embodied strategies to question assumptions and make choices that empower us in all aspects of our lives. Kimmy, welcome to the EWP podcast. It's a pleasure to have you with us today. And I was wondering if you could just start off by telling us a little bit about how you came to EWP, first of all, as a student and did your PhD with the department, and then how you ended up coming back to teach with us.
My name, I'm going to give you my traditional introduction. My name is Kimmy Karen Johnson. I am the daughter of Bernice Elvira Peebly and Edward Michael Gormley, the granddaughter of Joseph Earl Peebly and Mabel Johnson, and of Edward Gormley and Bridget O'Hara. My people come from the lands of what we now call Ireland and Scotland and a few other Northern European, but primarily that. I'm kind of a Celt all the way through. So I actually didn't graduate from EWP. I was in a program called the Traditional Knowledge Program that was started by Apila, Colorado. And it was a program specifically intended to support Native students in getting advanced degrees by studying their own cultures so that they would have academic credentials in the world too, but be within their indigenous knowledge base. And I think they awarded the degree through the, well, what did they award me the degree through? Transformative studies or something from another. So. But I, you know, took classes in EWP, and my dissertation chair, Danielle Delaurier, was the chair at one point of EWP for several years, and Fariba Bagzoran was also on my committee, and she was also an EWP graduate. So my affiliation with EWP goes back to when I was in graduate school. And then I started teaching, so and this was the logical program to teach in, since the program I'd gotten my doctorate in had been, unfortunately, did not survive, along with a number of other programs that were created under a lot of Rockefeller money that had been donated, and they created, I don't know, half a dozen programs. But without a really sustainable plan of how to support us. So, but I ended up, you know, teaching at CIS anyway.
Was the initial class that you taught the one that you taught with Apila? That was when I was in the program in 2006, I think.
I suppose that was one of the earliest ones. What was the class? Do you remember, Stefan?
I don't remember what it was called, but I think that it was on ancestors.
Yeah, I'm sure that's kind of what we did. You know, it was like I have been accused of teaching a dozen classes and all of them the same kind of class. I keep bringing people around to their ancestry and to the story of their people. So regardless of what the path is to get there, I get them there.
Well, I think, yeah, I think that it's one of your strengths. I think that when people come into the classroom with you, they get you. And that's what they come for. And the subject, you know, kind of weaves around your central interests. But your central interests are this kind of living, breathing expression and experience of what it is that you do.
Well, you know, one of the things that has been so actually one of the parts of my spiritual life and my journey since I was a child is my relationship to the earth and to plants and animals. And what's been happening on our planet with global warming and all of these innocent beings that includes humans, but definitely I was so moved. There was a story about a bear up at the Caldor fire. They saw this bear that obviously its paws were really burned. And they decided, I don't know who, anyway, that it was too large to transport. So they euthanized it because they said the fires were coming and it was going to be killed. But I mean, that the suffering on this planet right now is really rather staggering, and to really hold on to a sense of an unfolding of this incredible force that is life and is life in all forms on our planet. It takes a lot to try to hold to that and not lose a sense of that, and also to not be overwhelmed by guilt and regret of being a part of a species that is doing this to the rest of the planet. You know, it's just the traditional elders and teachers that I studied with during my 7 years in the traditional knowledge program, and that I've been blessed to be with at times since then, you know, that the every one of them, their people had this profound relationship to place and a sense of being children of that place. In other words, they really, over and over, I heard these elders talk to us about their people and the obligation to the land that they were the children of. And you know, that resonated so deeply with my own sense of where I grew up on the Nebraska prairie, out in the Nebraska sandhills, and my relationship to that land. So I'm still, you know, I'm experiencing, I'm really holding in my heart and in my soul a sense of, I don't know, just wanting to hold with as much love as I can muster the suffering of these beings and to not run away from it, to not, you know, just go, I can't look, it's too hard. It's too hard. But at this stage of my life, I can really manifest to do something to write that. I'm not sure. I guess what my path is and has been for a number of years now is in really inviting the people I'm privileged to have as students to wake up to who they are and to their relationship to place. And it's just a wonderful thing to see when it happens. It makes my heart happy.
You're bringing to mind that I grew up on Long Island, and you know, Long Island is as big a mess as any other kind of suburban, flowing into urban, spilling over into urban area.
Did it get hit really hard by Ida? Excuse me.
I think they had one bad day.
Okay.
And I contacted my friends. My daughter is there. She said it was one really bad day of rain, and then the next day it was almost as if it hadn't happened. So I was in New York City 2000, I want to say in the early 2000s, but I can't remember the exact year, the first time that I saw flooding in the subway. I was trying to get downtown from the Upper East Side, and I couldn't get in the subway. I went back to get my bicycle and tried to ride my bicycle along the FDR, and the flooding came up above the handlebars of the bicycle. It was so bad. It was the first time I had ever seen that kind of torrential rain in the area, and it was a sign of things to come. But I was thinking, what you were saying is kind of brought to mind that I grew up, you know, on Long Island, and Long Island has a lot of really beautiful areas. The seashore is gorgeous there. I've spent a lot of time when I was growing up on the water and at the beach. But also the North Shore of Long Island, especially where I grew up in Nassau County, it was hilly and still forested, more sparsely populated. But there's one place, it's an arboretum. It's essentially a formal garden. It was an estate. It's very large, but it was an estate. And when I was a teenager, I discovered this place. And when I would go there with friends, I never wanted to leave. There was a lawn where there were these huge trees that were hundreds of years old. And I just felt like this is my place. You know, if I could be buried there, I would be buried there. And I find myself longing, I have deep longing just to go back to this one place. And I have no knowledge of any connection with it. It could be just the beauty of the place.
Well, it could be. Now, I'm not saying this is true, but I remember, a number of years ago, this one student who was from, her ancestry was from, which was it? It wasn't Sweden. I think it was, anyway, it was from an island out off of Sweden, somewhere up there. And she had this just real desire to go back to see this place. And she did. She went in to see it and felt, you know, and the people there, she looked like the people there. She was just a second generation. And then she took her son, her young son, there a few years later. And they were driving this road, windy road, to go to the village where her family had come from. And they came over the crest of a hill, and this little kid, I don't know, he was like 8 or 9, pointed and he said, "Those trees don't belong there." And there was some trees planted on a hillside that had been planted there for a harvest for wood. But this kid somehow, it was very remarkable, in his DNA, he knew those trees didn't belong there. So you could be, and another story is that illustrates that, is a woman from of African ancestry who absolutely felt no connection to the land here, and then went to visit Africa, didn't feel connected there. So here she is in my class, and all these people are feeling connected to their places and people, and she feels nothing. And then she was sitting at the at her dentist's office and picked up the obligatory National Geographic, which is usually there, and opened it up. And there was a picture of this landscape in Tanzania. Oh, also, she said the only place she'd ever dreamed about was this landscape in the foothills of the Himalayas. And when she opened up this magazine, it was a similar landscape to what she had dreamed. Well, she ended up going to Tanzania. She was a sculptor. And she ended up getting stone from there. I mean, she ended up with this incredible relationship with this part of the land in Northern Africa that she had been seeing in her dreams, but she had no idea that she was connected to anywhere on the planet. So I suspect there's some connection there for you. And also there's definitely a connection that place saw you and comforted you and supported you and held you and still would.
Although that's beautiful, thank you. And I would the first time that my wife brought me to India, we traveled in the Himalayas, and we visited a place called the Nubra Valley. You have to go over like 19,000 foot mountain pass in order to get into it. And the first night that we were there, that we were at a guest house, and they told us as we were having dinner, oh, you should, you know, in the morning, you should go out and walk behind the house. There's a garden and there's a gate. When you walk out through that gate, there's a road, a dirt road, and that's the old Silk Route. That was actually part of the Silk Route. So we thought, well, we're just going to go out this evening. The sun was setting, but it was the moon was bright. I think it may have been a full moon that night. And we were walking along the path, and I was gazing up at the hills around. You know, it's in a valley, so I was gazing up at the hills, and there was a Buddhist monastery up on the hills. And the moon was rising above the monastery, and I had a powerful, powerful feeling that I had been there before. And I turned to my wife, and I just about to say it, and she was like, "I know, you know, me too. I've been here before."
And
we didn't know whether we traveled together. Maybe it's nice to think that we did, but there was a third person in our party who came up to us, and we said, Hrithik, we're having this really extraordinary experience, and that we've been here before. And he said, "I've been here before also." He said, "I was killed on this stretch of road." It came to all three of us at the same time, just walking that stretch of road. So yeah, there are places to remember, or we remember, or.
Well, places definitely remember. I mean, that's part of the dream that really guided my work I had when I was like probably 4 or 5. And the land that I was living on had been the land of the Lakota and the Cheyenne and the Arapaho. And there had been a massacre there in 1855 of a band of Brule Sioux and Cheyenne families, and that had come up from what is now Kansas. They'd done their winter hunting, and they were attacked by this force of Army, U.S. Army soldiers. And I had never heard of that. I'd never heard anybody talk about it. I didn't hear anybody talk about it for years, but I had this vivid dream. And the land knew that that had happened, and the land brought me that dream. I have no doubt about it. And that dream has really been a impetus, a motivating force for the work that I do.
Kimmy, could you talk a little bit more about what you mean by ancestors and ancestry? And maybe you could help share your, you know, the first time that you encountered the power of reconnecting and remembering your ancestry in that way. And I guess the question that would come at the end of that for me was how do we remember? You know, I guess it changes different for everybody in a way, but how do you bring that into the classroom, and how do you sort of situate these kinds of questions in EWP?
Well, you know, in my classes, because of my the path that I am walking, and Apila, Colorado's, by the way, Apila has a just out a book called Woman Between Worlds. I absolutely recommend it completely. It's the story of her journey in remembering. So, you know, for me, what I did in terms of, quote, remembering the ancestors or remembering myself was to walk back through, collect stories by hearing stories from my family about my ancestors. And then I began to do a migratory story of how they'd come across the United States. And then, you know, getting the oldest records that I could from, thank God for the Mormons and their family history center. And it's like, those are just things that we do. One of the things I tell my students is that so much of genealogy in the last years has been just people kind of, as we are wont to do in our culture, is to accumulating names. And that's not what the work is. I mean, that is certainly something to do. But one of the things about those names is to, I remember this elder, I think Lakota elder, this man saying, and it brought me to tears. He said, your ancestors have been waiting a very long time to hear their names, and that they will come to you, but you need to ask them to come to support you. And, you know, as I began to reclaim those names, this was on my mother's side of the family. I didn't have any information on my father's side. I was born during World War II. My mother and father met. He was already married. She didn't know that. He was an Air Force, in the Air Force in Denver, and that's where my mother was living at the time. And I didn't have any information about him at all. But I did research my mother's lineage back to the early, 1706 or something was the first family member that they traced it back to. Now, on my father's side, now I know I'm just his parents were immigrants from Ireland. And he was the first generation born here. But on my mother's side, it goes back a long way. And as I found those names and some of the stories, I felt something really, it was really interesting. It was like somehow I was part of a larger story than just my own personal, we're very much the individualistic therapeutic society that we live in. And Jung's thing about you have to expand your consciousness to have a bigger life. That was really true. That opening up for me was really powerful. And then as I saw my students begin to, what unfolded for them, I remember this one student, he was a real isolate. He had no real relationship with his family. He lived in a basement apartment somewhere. And didn't really relate to people much and didn't feel, he didn't want anything to do with his family. But I suggested that he gather names. And so he put up butcher block paper on a wall in his basement and he started writing down his ancestors' names in this tree across his wall. And then he got some pictures and got other information and added it in. And by the end of the class, I'll never forget, he talked at the last class. And he said when he was in his apartment there in the basement that he was no longer alone. He said, they're all with me. I feel them with me. And it just, I realized when he said that I had been experiencing that in my life too. Maybe not quite as suddenly, but that I had been experiencing that sense of a presence of being held by those that had gone before me. Now, I know that, you know, people always ask me about past lives, about reincarnation, and how I responded to that was Helen Palmer, when I was 22 years old, long before I was on this path, I went to see her. She was an Enneagram later, but she was the best psychic that probably California ever produced. And I went to see her, and I'm sitting there in all my 22-year-old idiocy and thinking, you know, I don't know what I thought. But she said, so what do you want to talk about? And I hadn't thought about that. I said, oh, past lives. I mean, this was in the 60s, so of course it was going to be past lives. And she said, so what's going on in this one you don't want to deal with? Slam. It just took the wind out of my sails. And it's like, that's what I tell my students. It's like, there are things that you don't probably end up in my class unless your ancestors got you there anyway. I mean, there are things in your lineage that you need, you're being asked to look at, being asked to own, being asked to celebrate, being asked to be supported by. And so at least for my class, you can do whatever you want with in other classes, but in this class, focus on your blood ancestry and see what wants to come through. See what's waiting for you to discover, because I never know. Students come into the class, inevitably and think they're going to focus on their mother's side or their father's side or in this or that, and then it unfolds and often it goes a completely different way. So, you know, for me, that sense of connection with the ancestors, I had one funny experience. I was in, it was some class I was in at CIS, and they put on Michael Harner drumming. And so we were supposed to have this little journey, and we were supposed to, you know, invite an ancestor in or do something, invite a spirit in. And so I invited an ancestor in, and I, of course, was hoping for the goddess to appear or something like that. And instead, there was this image in my mind of this, like, tundra of a hill. I can still see it as clear as, and a little kind of icy stream, little trickle of water coming down. And over the hill comes this stocky, hairy, naked guy who is having his spring bath out there, and he's dancing, and he's just full of joy, and he's in and out of this icy water. And I knew it was an ancestor. You know, it wasn't who I expected, but it was just, you kind of have to definitely let go of what you expect and see what comes. And anyway, I think that little character has been with me ever since.
It's such a great story. Imagining it myself, it's really lovely. I was actually just talking about this with students from my own class this morning. And I was thinking about Jung had once said, or maybe in a few places, he said that our personal karma kind of begins about 150 years before we're born. Now, I think the reason for that, he doesn't explain it. I would say that the reason for that is biblical, that the sins of the father are visited onto the children, onto the third generation. So roughly 150 years, you might think in those terms. I don't know. I could be completely off base. But he said that our responsibility is to our, we have a responsibility to our ancestors. And he even put it in very stark terms. He said that we need to live their unlived lives for them. That's what they're asking of us. And I was thinking that, you know, my father, he died back in 2001 at 73. He was young and he had prostate cancer. And I had the good fortune of being able to be with him for the last few weeks without having any other responsibilities. So I spent a lot of time with him, and one day we were alone. I think my mother was out and all other family members were gone. And he told me this story about this woman that he had been in love with before he met my mother, and the relationship ended poorly. And I think he just made a turn in his life and wound up with my mother, and the rest was history, as they say. So, but he asked me if I would get in touch with her. He gave me her name. He said, see if she's still alive. And I could tell that it was unfinished business for him. And it was really sad. And then at the end of the conversation, he said, forget it. He said, tear it up. Don't take the name. Don't do it, please. I've changed my mind. But I've thought about it a lot since that day. And in some ways, the energy, I don't know, the archetypal energy of that relationship that didn't work out for him is something that I've carried with me. And I could see it unfold in my own life in so many ways, that there really is a call to kind of untie the knots that our ancestors couldn't. My father couldn't untie this knot. I don't know that I have in my life. Hopefully I've pushed it a little bit forward and haven't like gotten it more entangled. But so I think I'm only saying this because I just want to say that I really agree profoundly with what it is that you're saying. And once you begin to experience these things, at least for me, once I began to experience these things, it opened up a different universe to me that is so vast. It's beyond my capacity to understand, but it's real. I feel it as real.
Well, you know, it reminds me of, it wouldn't be seven, but the native thing of seven generations forward and back. You know, it's we are definitely you know, it's like we are definitely made up of our ancestors' stories and experiences, and those who follow will be made up of ours. You know, it's one of my students, this man who kept having, he was in his like 50s, and he kept breaking off relationships, and he was in a relationship and his partner wanted to have children. She was younger than him. And he had this fear because his father had left him and his mother when he was 2 years old. And he knew that his grandfather had also abandoned the family on that side. And so I suggested he go back and research this. And he did, and it was just startling. He found abandoning fathers back to the Revolutionary War, when that an ancestor then had gone, was a drummer boy, and had gone into the Revolutionary War as a drummer. Anyway, this kid had been at many of the main battles of the had seen the carnage of what had happened. And he went home, and he had, he married, he had like four or five kids. And when he was 28 years old, he left, and no one ever knew where he went. He just abandoned them all. Every one of his sons, the oldest son after that, abandoned their families. I mean, it was just, you know, this man, my student, had no idea that there was this. And being able to see what the pattern was and knowing that he wanted to choose differently. I mean, I think what recovery does for us is it gives us choices. Because otherwise it's like something operating. It's like the operating system on my computer. It kicks up and those experiences from our ancestors are the operating system that is flowing through us. And if we don't know what happened, we can't choose differently or shape things or, you know, really resolve some of the grief and wounding for them as well. So, you know, it's just it's an amazing journey, really, to begin to unfold that. I mean, my father, the man who was my father, died at the age of 28. He was a tail gunner over Germany, and he was in one of those bubbles underneath the planes, and it jammed when the plane was being shot down, so the plane went down with him in that bubble. And I ended up being able to talk to the son of his best friend who was in that plane with him. And I went through that story, that remembering. I felt like it was excruciating. I felt like I was going down in that plane with my father. And I think we have to kind of show up. And I mean, being there for him, I also, my grandmother, my mom's mother, was murdered in front of her when my mom was 15. And what this wonderful medicine man from Alaska, Amawak, he told me that I needed to enter into the story of my mother, my uncle, and my aunt, and to write their story, to write it out, and then to take it and burn it and put the ashes in moving water. And I did that over about a 3 or 4 month period. And oh my God, I mean, to enter into the pain and their confusion as children and, you know, the horror of that, but it freed me, at least in large part, from that story. And so, you know, I think we have to show up and let them tell us their stories if they're willing. Because, I mean, your father got to tell his story to you about this love. And I think that healing, you know, in a way, that's part of what you offered him. And that's the beauty of that.
And I think that he realized also that he had lived his life. He had made his choices and he had lived his life. He came from a broken family. And he actually did not know his mother, his mother and father split up when he was four, and it was really, really awful. And his father would not let him see his mother. And when my father grew older, he didn't want to see her. He felt that she had abandoned him. So he carried a pattern inside him. And yet he was able to see that he had made choices in the real world that had lasting effect. He had four kids, you know, and he had a wife whom he loved and who loved him. But yet there was still something slightly unresolved, but maybe resolved in that moment. I don't know. Or maybe he gave it to me. You figured this out.
Yeah.
Which I have not been able to do.
Maybe you need to write it out and burn it and put it in some moving water.
I think that's a great idea.
So, you know, suggestions of things like that, of medicine things to do, was part of the joy of being able to study with the Pila and with traditional elders. You know, there was just, I long sometimes, pardon the phone, I'm sorry. I long sometimes for a medicine person to go to and ask them, okay, what do I do with this now? And Pila told me a number of years ago, she and I were driving through over here at Samuel P. Taylor Park. I was living out in Point Reyes at the time, and she said, pull over, and I did, and she went into the redwoods there with her pipe and prayed. And when she came out, she said, I got it, Gimme. She said, I understand why we keep wondering why when our teaching and things, the impact it has on our students. And she said, you know, we've been carrying their teachings all along from these elders. She said, we're not carrying them now outside of us, it's inside of us. They've become part of us. So, you know, that was a lovely moment.
Kimi, could you talk a little bit about how you have brought in traditional knowledge and indigenous pedagogy into EWP? Because I have that question because I know that in a place like EWP, you can bring it in with all the integrity that you have and that you've explored in your life, that other mainstream academic institutions would probably not be so welcome to. But I just wanted to ask you if you've encountered problems with this kind of intersection with, you know, a knowledge academy in that sense, in a formalized sense, and these other indigenous ways of knowing and pedagogies, and also your relationship of being an outsider to that culture, and how you at a certain point in your life became more of an insider, and how you navigate this kind of these kind of porous boundaries, I guess. So a couple questions, but
well, I'll see if I can hold them here in my mind. Well, you know, one of the things that when I was working on my dissertation, and it was over a kind of extended period of time because I brought my mother and my aunt had come out to live with me, and I was caring for them. My aunt had emphysema and was in the last 2 years of her life, and my mother had, actually it turned out Lewy body's dementia, she had Parkinson's, and I was caring for her. And it was 24/7, I was with these two wonderful elders. So it took a while to get my dissertation finished. But what I did was I tracked, the dissertation became the story of my remembering my relationship to place, my remembering my relationship to the trees, to the animals, etc. And this wonderful man who was a really dear friend was a professor emeritus from San Francisco State in theater. And he watched me struggle with this until finally one day he said, look, come over to my house. And for 3 days, I think it was 3 days, he asked me questions and we recorded it. And that recording became 80% of my dissertation. And so when I was writing it, then when I really started getting it down, a dear friend of mine who's much more of a quote academic than I am, I'd written the proposal and I gave it. She said, do you want me to see if I can, you know, make this a little more academic, you know, because I mean, I was just my usual circular way of doing things. And so she took it and she revised it for me. And when I read it, I got dizzy. I couldn't. I mean, it was like I can't do this, you know. And it wasn't like she had changed words or, but it. I had to tell my story in a way that it unfolded within me, because that's how it had come to me, and that's how the land had taught me had raised me to speak. And so I wrote the dissertation very aware that it might not be accepted. But I also wrote the dissertation knowing that I had to be true to the process of remembrance of Indigenous mind. I wanted to write it in language that was so clear that the guys down at the S&S Cafe in Oshkosh, Nebraska, the old cowboys who sat there and had coffee every morning, could read it and go, oh yeah, I understand that. So I submitted it going, well, that's the only way I can write this. I could write something else in academia, but I couldn't write this. The dissertation really has absolutely maps out how I teach. Really not much, I don't have much to add. So, I mean, it was amazingly complete for me and the work that I'm to do. And because of being really fortunate to have Danielle Delaurier as chair of EWP when I was finishing that, and he was on my committee, and, you know, being invited in to teach in EWP and really brought in, it was just, I just had some really wonderful allies, you know, in the program. And yet, I mean, I've never been really a part of I was invited to apply to be to come on the faculty, but I was living in Point Reyes and frankly just could not imagine a commute like that, and I didn't want to leave. So I was on the land where I wanted to be at the time, and so I've always had kind of a good relationship with the faculty in EWP. I will tell you, living on adjunct faculty salary is a practice in Indigenous ways of knowing. You know, I felt like I've been asked to walk a path of a certain amount of poverty just to stay true to what I'm doing. And I don't regret that. Now, was there another part of your questions?
I guess it was maybe some of the problems of translation between something that maybe can't be translated, like the translation of Indigenous mind into something like English, or into, I mean, you address the idea of academic language being not true to the experience that you wanted to voice, to bring to the discussion, right? But I guess that's just that idea of translation is really interesting, and it sort of is a part of the work that I do, which is between cultures as well. And I think it seems as though what I'm hearing is that you were able to go in to the dissertation not compromising on that translation for the sake of trying to appease the academy or something, which I think is super, that's amazing. That's so beautiful and really inspiring. And
well, Jonathan, it wasn't going to happen if I violated it. It was just not going to come. It was not going to be alive in me. And, you know, I feel so blessed because I came to graduate school later in life after, you know, doing all kinds of crazy things with my world. But it was like I finally had found my path and I'd found my work. And nothing was worth compromising that for me.
It has had a life of its own in a way that you had to be true to. It had its own path or its own life way, maybe, in a way that you were in harmony with.
Yes,
it was you, but
such a gift to be able to, you know, I still feel that. I feel that whenever I'm teaching or writing or reading, that it's such a gift to have been given this work to do. It's just an honor and a blessing.
That's beautiful. Yeah, I was stumbling for words. I kind of felt like, oh, I don't know whether anything needs to be said after that. But for the sake of conversation, when I became one of the first tutors in the writing center when Matthew Bronson started the center, and we were looking at examples of academic writing, and it was very difficult because I think like you in a way, I don't understand academies. It's not a language that I feel comfortable with at all. And I've been in programs. I was in a Marxist feminist program, anthropology program at City College in New York City. And the jargon that was prevalent, this is in the 1990s, so it was very kind of postmodern, very deconstructionist. And it just didn't feel right. I wanted an ensouled language. I wanted, you know, I was wondering why I couldn't, I was interested in Jung back then. I was wondering why I couldn't study Jung. And this was the dominant voice in the academy. And it's still there. And there are people who master it. Debashish has mastered it in a really wonderful way. And he can ensoul it, which is extraordinary. I don't have that capacity because it just doesn't, I can't feel my way into it. So I had difficulty as a tutor, at least learning from that perspective. But there are many people in CIS and especially in East-West that can't do it that way. So we get a lot of dissertations. It's not their language. Their language is much more direct and more ensouled. And that's one of the really wonderful things about the department, I think, is that we allow it. I mean, we make space for it. We don't block it. We don't try and obstruct it. But it's what's coming through the students when they come into the program because it's what they're looking for.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I'm glad. I always enjoy, I mean, I thoroughly love the students at CIS. I enjoy the classes, getting to know them. A number of them have stayed in my life over the years. You know, it's just, it's really, I'm very grateful for that program and for what it has, what the path it has given people to walk, you know, that they've found their way. And that's so important. So beautiful.
Well, I'm thinking of it, Jonathan, this may be one of your questions anyway, and you can always cut and splice if we have to, but I'm just curious. So you'll be teaching for us next semester, and I'm not sure which class you're going to be teaching, whether it's the Indigenous Wisdom class or the Ancestor class. And then you've also been in discussion about teaching an online class over the summer, right, on Ancestral Journeys, I think it's called. So could you maybe talk a little bit about those? Is there anything that you could share?
Well, the Ancestral Consciousness and Healing class is really the students are asked to specifically focus on researching, you know, information about their families, of identifying breaks with the relationship to the land, just to their culture, but also woundings within, sometimes it's within the last, you know, generation. I mean, breaks, like I was talking about the abandoning father for that one student. So it's about finding what those breaks are and finding ways to work with that to bring healing. Shamanic traditions is looking at traditions from one's, we all come from hunter-gatherers. And hunter-gatherer cultures, by and large, all had what we now call, incorrectly, but shamanic traditions, which are land-based medicine that arises from the place. And it's specific to place. So I invite people to research information about the, you know, the rituals, the ceremonies, the whatever they can find from the land of their ancestors, one branch or another of their ancestors. Many of us have, come from quite a mix. And then to find a practice that is part of that ancestry, and then to begin to work with, it might be drumming, it might be, you know, raising plants, it might be singing, it might be dancing, but to find a practice that was part of a shamanic tradition within their ancestral lineage and to work with it.
I thought I should get naked, smear myself with bear grease, and go out and fight the Romans, because that's what my people were doing.
You could do that.
Back in the day.
Yeah, those were my people too. I know. I remember when I first, I was walking down the halls of CIS when I was just had gotten on this path, and I met Jürgen Kramer in the hallway. I'd been in the library reading about the berserkers and about the, you know, about my ancestors running around with skulls hanging off their belts and, you know, carrying on. And he said, "Oh, how are you doing?" I said, "They all disgust me. they're barbarians." He said, "That's right. That's who we are." Anyway, it was kind of funny to have gone through that. And also to change, you know, I was raised hearing about like the Neanderthals or the cave, you know, it's like just like this disparaging way of looking at these people. And I have come to just honor and feel awe at my ancestors from Europe and from the British Isles that came through those ice ages, that came through all those generations of the migrations, you know. And it's just, we'd had such a warped way of looking at them. I don't know how I got off on that, but there you have it.
Right. Well, that brings me to a question about this intersection of the past and the future. You know, like the fact is that a lot of your work is going back into ancestors, looking back at the past, while at the same time, you know, making productive, finding a way to make that productive in one's life, you know? And I guess I wanted to ask you about the challenges to somebody like me. I would just say I'm from, you know, I'm Anglo from British heritage, growing up in Canada, but I also have been in India and traveled a lot. And the global village is sort of a container that I've sort of grown up in. And there's an aspect which is, I guess I'm wondering about authenticity in terms of how can we really know how we are situated in this intersection of the past, which is genetic and which is through bloodline, but also through larger cultural containers and containing myths, and how those are being sort of being put into collision with other containing myths. But I guess that question of authenticity and how do we construct a future based on this practice of connecting with the ancestors.
That's a very, you know, I think that's an excellent question to explore for each person exploring it, because the amount of integration, the amount of healing that needs to be done with one's ancestral lineage oftentimes is going to take up a lot of energy and time, because it's not a simple path. And I think to move forward without that healing, without working with those, you know, with often the frightening reality of what our ancestors have done here and in other places, or what's been done to our ancestors, without holding some of that and working with it, that what we do is we perpetuate the same things. So we really need to work with that. It's not like either or, but it's like it's kind of begin where you're standing. And if where you're standing, that there is healing that still, and not that all of it can be done by one person in a lifetime, but at least if you haven't started to integrate and work with the reality of what your family story means. I mean, I had to face that with, I assumed that because we were poor and coming through from Tennessee to ultimately to Missouri, and then I'm looking at records from Missouri and come across this notice of the sale of the slaves of my great-great-great-great-great-grandfather. And it was just, I had no idea. I thought, okay, at least I'm not, you know, I didn't. So I went through an experience, a remarkable experience of being able to contact a descendant of one of those slaves who, through the National Genealogical Society, and he wrote an article for them. He was an awesome researcher. He was a retired FBI agent. Man, that guy could find out anything. So, but I put, he had a picture of his ancestor who had been my family, my great-great-grandfather's slave. And so I had that picture on my computer for years. When I would open up my computer, I would see the face of this man. And really had to do some work with that. Really had to do some, you know, to realize how much I had wanted to distance myself in my mind from that part of the story of this land. And, you know, I did it through writing. I did it through prayer and ceremony and talking to people. But it felt like I had done an important piece of work for my family when I did that. So my answer, I don't know if that really, you know, and I think when we do that healing, where we begin where we're standing, we work with what we're carrying with us, as we move forward, we carry the strength of that with us, of the fact that we have been willing to face those stories that oftentimes have been buried. And we won't create such devastation as we move forward. I'm enjoying looking at you two, at your faces. It's just really lovely to see. I don't know you, Jonathan, now. I feel like I do a little bit, but to see you, Stefan, it's just, you're beautiful. Well, this feels kind of complete to me, but maybe do you have other questions, Jonathan?
I was thinking the same thing. You know, endlessly generate questions. I think that's part of being a student, but knowing when to ask a question and when to just sit with what you already have is an important thing as well. And
that's true.
Yeah,
that's
and true. I feel that I've really, really enjoyed our time together, and it's I really feel that there's a lot to sit with for lifetimes here.
Well, thank you both for doing this. I would love to see some of the other podcasts here. I don't know really anything about your project, so I'd like to know more about it. And I'm honored to be a part of it.
Great. Well, we're honored to have you. We will be releasing the first podcast probably next week, and we'll be releasing one every 2 weeks. And so I will edit this. I mean, not much to edit, but there's a couple little things here and there, and I'll mix everything and do what I do to produce it. And then I'll send it to you and you can listen to it. And if there's anything you want changed, then I can do that. Otherwise it will be released at some point. And I think it'll be just a good way for the EWP students to be able to get a little bit from everybody in our community. You know, because unless you're taking courses, I didn't take a course with you, and I feel like I missed out, but this conversation is at least something, and it's giving me a lot. And I think that I just want to be able to use this format to help all of our students in that way.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, it's important. I mean, you know, this work is so trying to explain to people who would ask me what I'm doing. And oftentimes I just cop out and just say, oh, it's in the field of like cultural anthropology or history or whatever I feel like saying right then, because to really go in to try to unpack it, you know. But CIS, you know, Hari Das Choudhury, all the whole vision that went into that school, I really pray for its well-being and pray for its support of the students that are looking for something. They are longing for something to find a path in their lives. And that's what There are a few places like that, not many, but that's what CIS has offered, what it offered me, and I'm grateful. So thank you both. Have a wonderful afternoon. You take care.
Yes, bless you too.
Thank you, Kim.
Yeah, thanks so much. Nice to see you.